The country of Haiti is under a state of emergency tonight after President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated early this morning.
Bloody manhunt underway now in Haiti to capture or kill the assassins who gunned down Haiti's president.
Police say they have arrested one of the masterminds behind the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. You're listening to recent headlines reporting the assassination of Haiti's president. Now, let me take a moment to read something to you. Quote, "The only thing that I saw before they killed him were their boots." These are the words of Martine Moïse, the First Lady of Haiti. Last week, she gave her first public interview since her husband's assassination. Haitians, still reeling from the assassination, have had mixed responses to the First Lady's account. It's been 3 weeks since her husband of 25 years, President Jovenel Moïse, was murdered, and she was left for dead. Police have arrested more than two dozen people in connection with the killing, including citizens of Colombia, Haiti, and the United States. But the arrests have done little to reveal just who is responsible for and what motivated the assassination. Mrs. Moïse shared her harrowing experience with Frances Robles of the New York Times. Frances, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
Let's just begin. Who does Mrs. Moïse think killed her husband?
She believes that, you know, she has kind of a broad word for it, the oligarchs, you know, the rich people that her husband had battled. She came very, very, very close to accusing one particular person. She went just as far as to the edge of the murder accusation that you could go in an interview without actually accusing someone of murder. And I asked her, so are you saying so-and-so killed your husband? I didn't say that. But there's a particular business person who she says had the most to benefit from her husband's death, and he denies it.
You know, as we've been covering the story here on The Takeaway over the past 3 weeks, we've had some of these conversations about the oligarchy, about the sort of powerful ruling classes, and about the fact that President Moïse, when he first came in, was certainly, you know, positioned himself as a champion of the people over and against these oligarchs. And yet we've also had conversations telling us that maybe as much as that was his early position, that in fact these oligarchs had done just fine under his governance. I'm wondering if there was anything in particular that the First Lady believed may have set off or caused, you know, something to move that group of people who she is zeroing in on to move against her husband in this way.
What I've heard the most from people is that, sure, he did go against a couple of oligarchs, right? So there's no question about that. I don't think you could say intellectually honestly, that he went after everybody, right? So if you look at the ones that he went after, you know, okay, so who did he initiate investigations? Who did he cancel their contracts? And that would be, there's a particular company that had an electric contract that he canceled. They were forced into exile. And there is a man named Reginald Bulos who was under investigation for an investment with the pension deal. He had a summons to appear in court and they had frozen some of his bank accounts. And she's really honing in on him because of the frozen bank accounts and saying, oh, look, see, right after he died, he got his money back. And that proves that he had something to gain. Mr. Bulos says, you know what? The bank account had less than $30,000 in it. And I got the account unfrozen by taking it to court and getting a judge to rule on it. I did this legally, and this is preposterous. You know, let's get to the bottom of who killed Mr. Moïse. So the thing that's so fascinating to me is that we now have, I think it's like 44 people, if not in custody, accused, and then other people in the United States who are also accused. And we really don't know who was behind that murder.
Whatever the politics of her husband, obviously the First Lady had an extremely harrowing, painful, difficult experience here. Can you talk to us a little bit about what your experience was like interviewing her, how she seemed, what her posture, her voice, that sort of thing was like?
Oh, Melissa, it was such an interesting interview. And, you know, I've been a journalist for over 30 years without dating myself here. And I have to say that it was one of the hardest I've ever done there's a sense from the Haitian social media universe that this was like a homicide investigation, right? That I'm going to go in there and interrogate her and be like, okay, well, you looking this way? Well, how many guns did he have? And, you know, what were you wearing? You know, you can't do that in a situation like that. You know, you have this lady that's just, you know, dressed in her in mourning clothes. And she has this big brace on her arm. She talks very, very low. She was afraid to have a translator of mine present just because she didn't trust anyone. So I had a translator tuning in on speakerphone. So if you can imagine that, you know, sitting there next to each other with a phone on the table, and she's talking like this very low. She was also with a large number of people. She had kind of an entourage with her, which made the whole situation extremely tense. Like, in addition to the fact that you have this person who's in mourning, who's injured, and then you have like 10 or 15 people watching, you know, watching you if you say something stupid or if you are maybe a little too pushy or rude. And I, you know, I'm a New Yorker, I'm pushy, I'm rude. And so I was nervous. I was like, oh no, you know, at any moment I'm going to say something and this lady's going to, you know, take her arm brace and walk out of this room.
So in this conversation where sort of all of these emotions are running high, nonetheless, there is kind of an undercurrent of courage, maybe even of resistance, at least that I read that coming through, particularly the first lady said her husband had a vision, the Haitian people will not let it die. And maybe even the possibility that she would run for president herself. Can you talk about how you saw the nature of her courage and resistance as well?
I see it through the lens of a person who's in mourning. I mean, I don't know if I was in her situation, if I would be, you know, hiding in a cabin in Montana. But you have to figure, you know, in addition to being very, very sad, I think she's really angry. I think she feels like, wait a second, am I going to let these people get away with it, not only, you know, not get arrested, but also get what they wanted, which was to not have him in power. I think there's a part of her who feels like, you know what, maybe somebody has to finish what he started, and maybe that's going to be me. She was very careful not to say for sure whether that was something that she had decided. We know that she has a number of surgeries still that she has to go undergo. In fact, she might even be going to the hospital this week. You know, I wonder if that's going to stick. I just think, what are the logistics of that, right? Security wise, how is she going to be president? How would she be president of Haiti? How does she go to an event? How does she go to the shanty towns? Mm-hmm. How many security officers does she have to have? Who's guards her presidential home? I think that that's an enormous, enormous task, but it sounds like she's saying that she's not going to let them scare her out of it.
It's really helpful to hear you frame it that way, that it didn't sound as though this was a big power grab that she had definitely decided on, but rather that this is part of that process of grieving, of mourning, undoubtedly of shock, as she is still processing what it means to have had her. And again, whoever he is politically, he was her partner and her husband for 25 years. Did she talk at all about other members of the family? I know that you write that by the time the assassins had entered their room, she believed that everyone else in the family must already be dead, that all of the security must already be dead, because how else could these assassins have breached the private chamber? And yet we know, of course, that not only were the other members of the family not dead, but that in fact only she and her husband sustained these kinds of injuries. Did she talk about the family, about how others are doing in this moment?
They had a pretty strict, don't talk about the kids, don't ask them to speak policy for this interview, even though they were present. And they're not, you know, they're not babies, they're not 12 years old. So she, you know, she said they're doing as well as you would think that somebody would be doing going through a night like that with the dad that they had been talking to that whole day. And then all of a sudden he's gone. The other thing that she mentioned, she shared an interesting anecdote that one of the reasons that she thought that everybody was dead was because she thought that she was dead. She didn't call it an out-of-body experience, but she said that she could hear the voices that were right there in the room, they sounded really far away, like distant. So she thought that she must be far away, right? She's like, well, I'm laying here dead, you know, watching this from somewhere else. And then realized, wait a second, no, I'm not dead. I'm still alive. And as she listened to these people rummaging through her house and through her room.
Let's talk about that rummaging. She says that they were looking for something. Can you tell us more?
She doesn't know what it was. She says, so one thing that's important, she says that none of the people that were in the house, she said she sensed about a dozen people. Nobody was speaking French and nobody was speaking Creole, but they were speaking Spanish, and they were not like Haitian people speaking Spanish. You know, there was Spanish without accents. They were on the phone, or at least one person was on the phone. They were speaking to each other and they were saying, she said, and this part she actually said in Spanish, eso no es, eso no es, eso no es. You know, that's not it. That's not it. That's not it. And then she heard, eso es. That's it. She said they came looking for something and they found it. I said, what was it? She said, I don't know. And that it was found on a shelf where her husband kept his files. I mean, I wonder, you know, there's some degree of the things that she tells me that you have to wonder. I'm not saying that she's lying to me, but if she knows what it was, if she saw the killers, I don't know, the security wise, it's the wisest thing to tell the New York Times.
That's right.
I saw the guy and this is what he looks like. And let me draw a picture of him for you. You know, so.
And I know just what he was looking for, where he found it, and we're on the way. Yeah. Maybe exactly. Not for the New York Times. Yes.
Right. Exactly. You save that for the police or, to, you know, for the FBI. I'm not, you know, and again, I'm not calling her a liar. I'm just saying if I were her and I knew the answer to those questions, I would not have answered that. So that, you know, that's what she said. She said she doesn't know.
You mentioned the FBI just now. What is the FBI's role in this investigation? And maybe even more broadly, the role of the U.S. government in general going forward in Haiti?
Well, one of the things that's really important in all of this is that several of the people who have been implicated and who are in custody are actually United States citizens. They live in South Florida. So we know that last week there was a number of search warrants that were executed on those people's homes. I know that the First Lady was interviewed by the FBI herself. They have a sort of standard, we're providing our assistance and we will neither confirm nor deny. You know, you don't have to confirm it or deny it. You know, you turn on the local news and there they were in these people's houses. So the big question here is, you have these people in South Florida who were having like committee meetings about what to do if the government fell, you know, what kind of interim government could be held. And so those meetings are being characterized by the police as murder plotting meetings. If that's the case, then you have crimes that were committed in the United States. And then you're going to see the FBI's role probably increase.
Frances Robles is a national and foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Frances, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
This is the direct message Tunisia's youth want to send to President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Mr. President, people only want to live, and their voices are not heard. Go to the street and see with your eye.
You're listening to reporting from the Al Jazeera News Network back in January 2011, as a still nascent political uprising was gathering influence in the northern African nation of Tunisia after a young street vendor set himself on fire to protest treatment by the country's authoritarian government. By the end of 2011, the protests ousted Tunisia's authoritarian president, held the country's first democratic elections in over 60 years, and launched the Arab Spring. But the country's transition to democracy was rocky. Poverty and inequality continued, and last week, mass protests erupted in the wake of widespread frustration, a stagnant economy, and one of Africa's worst COVID-19 outbreaks. In response, President Kais Saied dismissed the country's prime minister, froze parliament for 30 days, and instituted a nationwide curfew. Tunisia is the last democracy that emerged from the Arab Spring that is still standing. Now it appears unstable. I'm joined now by Sharon Grewal, assistant professor at the College of William & Mary and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Sharon, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So talk to me a bit about the events that happened leading up to the president's actions last week.
Yeah, so there was a revolution in 2011 that succeeded in terms of its political dimensions. They held multiple free and fair elections. They passed a progressive constitution in 2014 by near consensus. But the revolution has not succeeded in its other elements on the social and on the economic front. By most metrics, the economy is even worse than it was under the dictatorship. And so those frustrations have led to perceptions that it's the political parties that are responsible, that are, have either been incompetent in terms of fixing the economy, or at worst, have been corrupt and have been stealing the nation's funds away from the people. And so that's the context in which this president, Kais Saied, was elected in 2019 in a landslide victory, 73% of the vote. But despite that popularity and that mandate he was given to come in to office and clean up the political system, he wasn't able to do it in the past year and a half. And the primary reason why is because the system that Tunisia set up under its democracy in the 2014 constitution is one in which the president is supposed to share power with the prime minister, with the parliament. And so what we've seen over the past year and a half is instead bickering between the president, prime minister, and speaker of parliament over their respective powers. And so nothing was able to get done. And so that's sort of the events that led up then now to the president freezing the parliament, dismissing the prime minister, and saying for the next 30 days, I am going to clean up the political system and fulfill really the second revolution that you have all been asking for to deal with corruption and get the economy back on track.
So when I hear words like, oh, I'm going to clean up corruption, I'm just going to hold this power for a moment while I do it, certainly in world history, that has typically led not to cleaned up democracies, but to authoritarian rule.
Yeah, it's worrisome. It really depends on what he does now. He has all of the power. There's no institutional checks on him. And so if he is true to his word and he will give up power in 30 days, maybe all will be well and Tunisia will return to a stronger democratic life. On the other hand, it remains to be seen. The military and police seem supportive at this point. In addition, he has a lot of popular support. And so you could really foresee a scenario where he says in 30 days, you know, I haven't yet been able to clean up the political system. We've made some strides, but I still need these exceptional powers for even longer. And so it remains to be seen what happens. That said, Tunisians across the spectrum are saying, have some faith. We have a strong civil society. We've toppled dictators before. We're not going to let this get out of hand. So we will see. But at the moment, it appears to be a power grab that really now depends on what he does with it.
Sometimes the expressed desire of a people for democracy is really about rules and institutions and checks and balances and all of that. And sometimes what the people are saying is, we want to live better. We want to have more dignity. We want to have more say. So when you're saying that the Tunisian people right now are saying, hey, we got this, does that mean there aren't massive protests or that there are massive protests?
So there were protests on the day that he then took power. There were protests throughout that morning, in particular against the political parties, against the moderate Islamist party Ennahda in particular, that many hold responsible for the situation that they've been in the past 10 years. And then there were celebrations as well once he announced these decrees that evening. But since then, it's been relatively quiet. The political parties that have called these decrees unconstitutional, have called it a coup, they've decided not to take to the streets in opposition. The Islamist party in particular, Ennahda, has expressed some concern that if they did go into the streets, that that would lead to confrontation that might then lead to violence. And so their strategy for now seems to be, let's wait and see. Let's put pressure on him vocally and try to make sure in 30 days that the parliament is reinstated and they can go back to normal.
Given the strategic geographic positioning, as well as the just sort of symbolism of Tunisia relative to the Arab Spring and democracy, how are the EU and the US currently responding?
The EU countries, notably Germany, France, Italy, as well as the US, have all expressed concern over these actions. They have not used the word coup, but they have said that we hope to see a return to democracy soon. And so they have expressed concern, but it's important, I think, that they keep up the pressure in the next 30 days and make clear that if he does not give up these exceptional powers when that deadline comes, that military and security aid, for instance, is on the table as something that legally the U.S. would have to suspend if there were a coup. And so that needs to be made clear so that the military and security forces in Tunisia don't support and help Kais Saied in extending that mandate beyond 30 days.
Sharon Grewal is an assistant professor at the College of William & Mary and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Want the good news first or the bad news? Not sure? Well, let's start with the bad. On Friday, an internal document from the CDC revealed that COVID Delta variant causes more severe illnesses and that vaccinated people may be able to spread it even though they're unlikely to become ill themselves. That's definitely bad news for all the schools and businesses planning a return to in-person schedules this fall. But the good news? Well, apparently the bad news has moved many of those most reluctant to get vaccinated finally to roll up their sleeves. In the past 2 weeks, Louisiana, Arkansas, Missouri, and other hard-hit states have experienced double-digit increases in daily vaccinations. Joining me now with ideas about how to make all the news into good news is Dr. Rhea Boyd, pediatrician and public health advocate. Welcome to the show, Rhea.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
Okay, so Dr. Boyd, it seems like the developments in COVID are ever changing. How do we make sure that the information that we are passing, and not just as media folks, but on our own personal social media or within our families, how do we make sure that the accurate information is what passes from us to others?
So there are important sources of information online that people can turn to if you're still looking for a few fast facts about the COVID vaccines. In fact, me and partners at Black Coalition Against COVID and Unidos US have created an online repository of videos that just answer questions from Black and Latinx healthcare providers for Black and Latinx communities about the COVID vaccines.
So I know on exactly that point, you're co-developer of The Conversation, which is really a national public information campaign to get that kind of accurate information out to Black and Latinx communities. When I was just now talking about the states that are hard hit, some of those states, particularly, for example, Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, have large populations of non-white citizens. Is that where we're seeing the under-vaccination?
It is, unfortunately. And to be honest, this is a predictable problem. These are all populations and states that have been chronically underserved by our nation's healthcare system. It's why we created this campaign, because we know that the reach of our healthcare system doesn't quite seem to always trickle down into our communities. And so we wanted to make sure that we are proactively reaching out, not just with the resource to actually get vaccinated, which is now pretty available across the United States, but to make sure that access to credible information about the vaccines helps people make this important choice.
So what works? What are the strategies or the messengers who really seem to pierce reluctance?
So one of the most important things is that we have messengers who look like and come from the communities that they're talking to. And so we have worked really hard to employ messengers from across the United States, but particularly who live and work in the southern United States, so that folks who are in these hardest hit states can see providers that they recognize, respect, and care for. The other thing that's important to acknowledge is that there are still major access barriers to the COVID vaccines. And so while the COVID vaccines are broadly available, like I said, across the United States, folks still have trouble actually accessing them if they work in a job that doesn't have paid sick leave or if they need childcare to get that time away. And so it's also really important for us to employ strategies that give people the resources they need so that they can take the time they need to get vaccinated.
I want to go ahead and just dig right into this issue that keeps coming up with particularly African-American Southern communities. Why is getting a COVID vaccine not the same thing as the Tuskegee experiment?
Oh, wow. Yes, this is a big topic. I think there is a rightfully earned concern and skepticism in Black communities about large government programs, because as you mentioned in the Tuskegee experiment, those programs have been used to exploit our community explicitly in the past. And so people are sensitive to that and people are wary of participating in anything that might put them at risk. And so when we talk to Black communities, the number one concern people have are about side effects. And there seems to be a concern that there's some hidden side effects that the scientific community isn't sharing with them. And so we're really honest about all of the data we have, not just from the clinical trials that included tens of thousands of folks, but now from the more than 150 million Americans who have received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine that tell us that these vaccines are safe.
I think it, for me, I just also want to focus on that question of trust for a moment, because as you were talking about the necessity of having messengers who are from the community and look like the community and are in relationship with the community, that was, of course, one of the most insidious aspects of the Tuskegee experiment, was that there was a Black woman nurse from the community who was used to help delay treatment, even the question of her complicity has been sort of challenged across the years historically. But again, as a physician, as a Black woman, as a pediatrician, help communities to understand why we ought to trust you and others in the community of medical providers.
One thing I think that the community can look at is one of the populations that was the quickest to be vaccinated nearly completely, more than 96%, were doctors in this country. Why? Because we were the ones who actually saw the devastation of COVID. The same in many ways is true of our Black communities. We are the population who is most likely to know somebody who has died, been made sick, been hospitalized because of COVID, either in our families or in our community circles. And so because we know that devastation, it's critical that we also know and have access to the best tool for prevention that our country has. And so sometimes when I have this conversation with Black folks, the other thing I say is, if you look around the world at places where COVID has spiked and there's been surges and folks have died in mass numbers, the number one thing that those countries are asking for from our country is the vaccine. This is something that is coveted globally. In Tuskegee, they were keeping treatment from us. Right now, we have treatment in our country that is not widely available throughout the globe. And so it's critical that people understand the unique opportunity they have as Americans to actually protect themselves.
Dr. Boyd, you're a pediatrician. When the vaccine becomes available for the little people, like my 7-year-old, would you suggest to parents that they access it for their children?
If the safety data remains as strong as the safety data that we've seen for children 12 years and up to receive the COVID vaccine, absolutely. Because we know that when kids go back into school, they are likely to be exposed in crowded settings to infectious diseases and colds, including COVID, come this fall. And we want to make sure that they have the protection that keeps them from being hospitalized or dying of COVID. And the one thing I'll say for parents to know is that kids are affected by COVID, and particularly if you are a parent of a Black child or a Latinx child, it's critical that you know that our children actually disproportionately made up children who are affected by COVID hospitalization and deaths. So we need to vaccinate our kids especially.
Dr. Rhea Boyd, pediatrician, public health advocate, and co-developer of The Conversation, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your clarity about this issue.
Thanks again for having me, Melissa.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban.
A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, I'm out of here.
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're listening to The Takeaway. For a long time, severe headaches like migraines and cluster headaches have been under-researched by the scientific establishment, even though tens of millions in the U.S. and globally suffer from this painful, recurring distress. Far too often, the experiences of headache sufferers are dismissed or ignored, both by doctors and by the people in their lives. Many of you shared with us how you're affected by headaches.
This is Mark Garrison from Dix Hills.
My name is Latanya from Austin, New York.
Amy in Northfield, Minnesota.
Hi, this is Neil from Snoqualmie. For me, it's extreme light sensitivity that makes my eyes feel like they're overheating and overexposed.
The fibular migraine hits, the waves of nausea are unbearable, and they're worsened by light and sound.
It can feel like my head is in a vice. from the neck up. Sometimes I can muddle through, but most times it literally stops me in my tracks.
I have had migraines for over 50 years, and I know my life would have been much different. Daily attacks curtail my enjoyment of life, and the search begins for new drugs and treatment.
So I'm out of commission for hours, and the next day I inevitably feel exhausted, so it's hard on my family.
Sound becomes too bright, and light becomes too loud, and nausea makes it impossible to enjoy. When I get a migraine, I'm forced to lie down in a dark room until it subsides, so it robs me of anything else I was planning to do.
I stay in bed with the curtains drawn and minimal electronics. The randomness is what is most disconcerting.
Thank you for being willing to share your difficult experiences with us. Luckily, we're a bit closer to understanding the causes of and cures for headaches, thanks to recent breakthroughs in the science and treatment of migraines and cluster headaches. For more on this, I spoke with Tom Zeller Jr., the editor-in-chief of the digital science magazine, UnDark. He's also working on a book about headaches, and Tom personally suffers from very severe headaches.
I get what are known as episodic cluster headaches. These are distinct from migraines, far less common. They are wildly, almost ridiculously painful, as I wrote about in my article. They're one-sided, and they occur sort of right behind my eye and in my temple. It's very typical. Most cluster headache sufferers have exactly the same symptoms. They come on without warning, often several times a day. This continues for weeks or months at a time before disappearing completely. That's where the name cluster comes from. They come in clusters throughout the year, although some people get them and they never go away. And those are called chronic cluster headaches. They've also had other names like Horton's headache, named for an old neurologist named Bayard Horton in the early 20th century, but also suicide headache, which I think speaks for itself.
As you talk about this experience of headaches, and we have some team members who suffer from migraines, and I know there'll be a lot of listeners who also suffer from migraines, give us a sense of the distinctions between the cluster headaches, which I think you've described so beautifully and honestly painfully, and migraine headaches.
Migraines, clusters, and also tension-type headaches, they fall into this sort of larger category of what doctors will call primary headaches. These are headaches that aren't sort of attributable to some other underlying problem, some external cause, like you had too much to drink the night before, too much stress, dehydration. They are sort of biological processes unto themselves, such that we know. And as I said, they come in those three flavors. Migraine and clusters tend to be the ones you hear about the most, although tension type headaches are somewhat more common. Those three categories kind of break down into lots of different flavors. So migraine sufferers will know that some of them get an aura, which is a sort of neurological disturbance, often visual, that comes before the headache. Although some people have migraine without aura at all. My cluster headaches are episodic. So they go away for a certain time during the year. Other people get chronic. So there are lots of flavors, but the distinction is that this is not your ordinary headache. This is not a headache from drinking too much coffee. This is a neurological disorder with a biological origin that we're only just starting to really understand.
So on that final point, that we're really only just starting to understand it, why don't we know more about the causes, consequences, and cures?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there are lots of different answers. I mean, on the one hand, the brain, the head is a hard thing to study, particularly when we're using them. So it's not just headaches, but a lot of what goes on inside the brain and inside our central nervous system is still rather mysterious even today, just because it's an incredibly complex system, hard to study. That said, there's lots of evidence. I think it's obvious that because women tend to disproportionately suffer from migraine headaches, I think it's something like 2-to-1 more common in women than in men. Clusters is sort of the opposite, tends to happen more often in men than women, although the data is sort of showing that there may be some underdiagnosis in women too. But the fact that women have these headaches more often and have had their own healthcare issues sort of disregarded by the medical establishment for many years, it's not surprising that we don't know as much about headaches maybe as we would have if, say, the opposite were true, if more men had been suffering from migraine headaches than women. I think that's a fair thing to say and almost certainly true. So I think it's a combination of factors. It's also, it's an invisible disease. I mean, you, if you don't have headaches, you and someone you know does, you can't see it. There's no tissue damage to look at. There's nothing broken. There's nothing bleeding, even though the pain can be some of the worst imaginable. It's invisible. So it's a very mysterious and very difficult thing to diagnose and to understand if you don't actually have them yourself.
Although we can't see headaches from the outside. If my daughter has a headache, I just have to take her word for it. She says, I have a headache, her head hurts. But if I had her hooked up to a machine, right? If I was looking at an fMRI, if she was in some kind of other sort of diagnostic tool, would I be able, as a physician or as a clinical researcher, would I be able to see the headache happening?
Yes, you could see sort of physiological structures lighting up in that way. You wouldn't obviously be able to see, as we can't anywhere, see the pain. But you could certainly see structures firing within the brain. You could see what is known as a cortical spreading depression, which we've been able to make very nice images of. This is the sort of wave of depolarization that happens across the brain just before a migraine, the pain of a migraine headache. And they think it's associated with the actual aura. The thing that you are experiencing when you get the aura is this wave of depolarization that sweeps across the brain. And we have images of that. So the answer is yes, you can see things happening, but it doesn't tell us that much about why it's happening or what triggers it, what processes are in play that sort of create that cascade of events that causes the pain.
Talk to me about the new research, first on causes and then on cures. So if the fMRI or whatever my mystical, magical machine might be that I was looking at can show me there's pain happening, but not the causes, what is research telling us about some of the likely underlying causes of headaches?
In terms of why they happen and why they happen particularly to some people and not others, is something that's sort of still a mystery. There's almost certainly some genetic factor at play, but that's not been perfectly identified. And it's certainly true that people have migraine headaches and cluster headaches who don't have anyone in their family that they know who suffers from these headaches. So it's not purely genetic that we know. It's nothing environmental that we've been able to firmly identify. But if you think of cause as, you know, what is the sequence of physical events happening in the brain that end up causing pain, that I think we're getting closer to understanding. And that's sort of where this new research is sort of fascinating to me. I mean, we know now that the trigeminal nerve inside the brain, inside the head, which sort of innervates the face, is definitely involved. It also provides nerves to the membranous tissue between the skull and the brain called the meninges. And this is almost certainly what is the locus of the pain. And we understand that, you know, a signaling process goes awry between that trigeminal nerve and the meninges, and the brain interprets that as tissue damage. You could think of it that way. The brain is thinking something is broken, something's been hurt, and so you feel pain. And so now the new medications are actually able to sort of say, okay, how can we start picking apart parts of that dance, parts of that sequence of events and interrupt it. And that's what these new CGRP drugs, for instance, are doing. Their CGRP is a neuropeptide that's issued by the trigeminal nerve that causes inflammation in the tissues of the meninges. So they reckon if we can stop that CGRP from either being issued in the first place or from being taken up by the neuroreceptors that they are targeted by, you could interrupt the pain cycle. And it's working for a lot of people. It's sort of the first drug that is specifically designed to prevent headaches from happening. And a lot of people are getting a lot of relief. The problem is that there are a lot of people who don't. So we're still missing something. We're still missing some universal, I don't want to say cure, but we're missing some fundamental sort of element in the headache cycle that would work more or less for everyone.
Talk to me about medications. It's surprising that on the one hand, there's so much pain here, but you've also written that in some ways, it's the best time in history to have a headache.
And when I say that, I think I'm referring to this sort of blossoming of research that's going on. And I think that started, you know, only in the last 30 to 40 years with our increased understanding of these cranial structures that are involved in the sequence of pain generation. So as we've come to understand that, pharmacological approaches have sort of blossomed and diversified. It used to be that, you know, we would mostly treat it with triptan class of drugs. Those do work really well. The problem is that they are designed to attack an individual headache. They're not going to stop your headaches from coming. So you can stop an individual headache, but not long after, often hours after, you're going to get another one. And those drugs can be toxic if you keep taking a lot of them. And that's been true of almost every drug. That's what's really exciting about the CGRP drugs is that the side effect profile seems pretty good so far. It's early days, but they seem to have few side effects, and they do tend to work for a lot of people. There are other non-drug treatments that are sort of being experimented with now, like vagus nerve stimulators and other sorts of nerve stimulators that you either hold in your hand and press against your vagus nerve in your neck, or that you attach to your head, that will send electric impulses and that some people are finding relief from. And pharmaceutical companies are also exploring all kinds of new stuff that are sort of in clinical trial now, from psilocybin, which is the key ingredient in magic mushrooms, which you may know of. A lot of people find relief from this. And so there's studies going on at Yale now that are looking into the effects of psilocybin as a treatment for headache. Vitamin D therapies. There's all kinds of stuff sort of in the mix. And so that's what I mean when I say it's a great time to have a headache. It's miserable to have a headache, but I don't think that there's been this sort of activity in the research field as it relates to headaches in a long, long time, if ever.
Help me to understand how all of us, whether we are working with folks who have regular headaches, whether we're parenting them, whether we are, in intimate relationships of any kind, how can we be better supporters of those who are experiencing the agony of headaches while we're waiting for the research to get us to a new point?
That is sort of the million-dollar question. And I think it's something I thank you as a headache sufferer for asking it. And I think a lot of listeners who have headaches would also thank you, because it's one that's not often asked. And that's partly because we all have headaches, right? But that's not migraine and that's not cluster. And they are in many ways sort of unfortunately tied to a word, headache, that is so sort of quotidian and just mundane that it's easy for us culturally and even understandable for people to sort of write it off or also think, you know, oh, sure, I get headaches. I know what you're going through. And the truth is that if you don't have these, you don't know what it's like. And you would do well to think of it as a real disorder. I mean, this person is experiencing a tremendous amount of pain. And if they tell you that they have migraines or they tell you that they have clusters, it'd be better off to regard that as someone telling you that they have a true neurological disorder that they don't have control over, and that it exposes them to an amount of pain that you probably don't personally know. And it can be incredibly debilitating. And so I think, you know, just being able to understand the distinction and recognize that if someone says they really need to kind of go into a room, a dark room, and lay down and battle this demon, believe that it's real. Believe that battle is something you don't want to go through.
I so appreciate that. Tom Zeller Jr. is the editor-in-chief of the digital science magazine, Undark. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Okay, folks, that's your Monday takeaway, and we've got good stuff lined up this week. You just cannot miss a day when you're dealing with information. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Back with you tomorrow.